Welcome to Your Call. I'm Angie Cuero, in for Rose Aguilar. Deer are something of a Rorschach test, a glimpse into the mind of each person you might ask about the brown, graceful beauties. They're a heavenly gift. They're hell on gardens. They're diminishing in number, and we need to do all we can to save them. Or they're pests that are multiplying as fast as ticks. They're also the source of conflict. To shoot them and eat them is cruel. It's something we don't need to do anymore. If you tell that to a hunter or someone deeply invested in wilderness life, you'll get a very different story. Hunters can be some of the most insistent voices on environmental preservation. The very person who strips them down for meat and hide can be passionately concerned about how much pain the animal feels as it dies. Then there's climate change. Interesting quote. They may even be able to turn climate change to their advantage. Now, how many species can you say that about? Erica Hauser is a poet, writer, journalist, and teacher, and the author of That Sentence and The Age of Deer, Trouble and Kinship with Our Wild Neighbors. You can see her years of poetry in her words, even as she brings us the science, research, and possible future of these fuzzy, beloved or not, fellow beings. Erica, welcome.
Thank you. So glad to be here.
Glad to have you. Erica also worked in local journalism for 20 years. She covered culture and environmental issues. She teaches writing. You can find her reviews and essays in various national outlets. I saw an interview with you, Eric, online with the folks at Biophilic Solutions. It sounds like rather than an urge to write about deer per se, you had a passel of other interests that deer turned out to be an ideal conduit for. Can you go into that for us?
Sure. Yeah, that's exactly right. Before I wrote this book, I did not have any special relationship with deer. Not a deer scientist. I'm not a deer hunter, but I was very interested in questions about how humans relate to nature and what we even mean when we say nature or say that something is natural. And I had been writing about those kinds of questions in different ways for a long time. And then it somehow occurred to me that, as you said, deer would be a great conduit or window into those questions because we have such a multifaceted relationship to them. They play multiple roles for us, and our relationship is very ancient and it's very deep. They've been providers for humans for thousands of years, and because of that, we've always addressed them in literature and art, and we've had a feeling of love and admiration for them. And so I could sense that deer could be a very, very juicy topic because of this relationship that's so old, but also very, very much present in our contemporary lives. We now live with deer as neighbors, so that makes for a lot of interesting interactions.
You just mentioned the fact that they've been prominent in art over the years. How far back do we see them depicted in art?
Well, as I write in the book, the big cave art galleries of Europe, for example, Lascaux in France, include a lot of images of deer. Actually, deer are one of the four most frequently depicted subjects in those cave art sites. So I think that does tell us something about their importance to people in that, you know, that era and that place.
And you also talk about, you know, beyond the art, you talk about deer and economics and class markers. There's a whole idea of deer farms, which came about and are still with us. What's the history of deer farms in a nutshell?
Well, deer are largely not domesticated animals, as we know, but there is a deer farm industry in some states in the U.S. It's not legal in all states, but notably Texas does allow deer farming, and this is done for various reasons. Deer are raised for not so much for meat, but they're raised as hunting targets and also as breeders to produce large, specifically large bucks with very, very oversized antlers. And then there are other things that can be done with farmed deer. There are scent attractants that are used in hunting that are produced on these farms. And actually the antlers themselves can be sold for various purposes. So it's a strange and a kind of multifaceted industry.
Mm-hmm. Let's tackle that quote that I mentioned at the top of the hour. Deer are Anthropocene heroes, mashup makers, remixers, shapeshifters, contemporary masters of disguise. You got to break that one down for us.
Well, what I'm trying to get at there is their adaptability. So they have proven to be just brilliant adapters. They've been around for about 4 million years. And of course, in that time, there have been innumerable changes to the earth, the climate, all of their habitats, and they have managed to persist and continue to evolve in, you know, many, many different parts of the globe. And in the last 100 or so years, what they've shown is that at least some species of deer, I'm especially thinking of the white-tailed deer that I live with here on the East Coast, but certainly in the Bay Area, people will be familiar with this as well. Deer are really great at living with people. Mm-hmm. They're really, you know, well-suited to living, you know, surprisingly well-suited to living in cities, towns, and suburbs. And so that has proven to be one of the most kind of interesting and salient things about them in our current time, the fact that they can kind of occupy the same spaces that we do.
Well, yeah, you know, because when you think of urban animals and smart foragers, I'm guessing raccoons would come to mind first for most mm-hmm. people. And when we see deer, I don't think we see them as much as city folk or urban folk. We tend to say, oh, well, they're briefly visiting us here from nature. They're inherently a wild animal. There are a couple of things we tell ourselves about nature and deer that just aren't bang on anymore.
Yeah, that's true. We do have this deep association between deer and wilderness or the wild, but it just really isn't accurate anymore. They're becoming a more urban species on balance because their populations are doing well in these human spaces and in more wilderness areas, or what we would think of as, you know, open space or public land or mature forests, their populations in those kinds of places are going down a bit. So their balance is kind of shifting toward the city. And it's not true that they only visit cities. They really live there. They reproduce there. They find everything they need there. And they're good at adapting to that environment. So they really do confound our beliefs about them.
Yeah. And, you know, while we're on the idea of nature and what's natural for nature, you talk, too, about this idea of the balance of nature. There's a common thought that if we leave nature to its own devices, there's some kind of norm that it would return to. And I think deer figure into that as well. We have this idea of what deer would live like if they weren't part of our lives. There isn't really a balance of nature per se.
Yeah, this is one of the trickiest things that I dealt with in the book. It was hard for me to get my mind around this idea because we are very much trained and cultured to think of that ideal of a natural balance and this belief that the earth has a sort of eternal perfect state that it would be in if only we weren't here, and that existed sometime in the past before humans started to alter everything. And I think what we need to do really is let go of that, to remember that the earth has been in a dynamic state of change for its entire existence, and that includes every species that has ever lived on earth, certainly including deer and us. We've got to let go of that. I call it the myth of Eden, this kind of idea that there was a perfect, paradise in the past on Earth. We've got to let go of that because it stops us from being able to effectively deal with the dynamic reality that we're in right now.
When we talk about deer, we haven't really established yet how many of them we're talking about, you know, what species we're talking about. Give us kind of the basic rundown, and we'll start with how many deer are out there.
Well, in the U.S., there are roughly, very roughly, about 30 million deer. And I say very roughly because it's hard to count deer, and the scientific focus is not necessarily on getting that total U.S. number, but rather people who study deer and their habitats are much more concerned about their density. So how many deer per square mile or kilometer are in a certain habitat? That's really what they focus on. But it's somewhere around 30 million deer. The majority of those are white-tailed deer, which are the deer that are found all throughout the eastern U.S. and parts of the West. In the Bay Area, you all have black-tailed deer, which are now considered a subspecies of mule deer. And mule deer are the kind of iconic Western deer, which are interesting because they are migratory, at least in their kind of undisturbed state. They migrate between a winter and a summer range, which whitetails do not do. Whitetails just stay put in the same relatively small home range throughout their lives.
And what kind of range are we talking about for the black-tailed deer and the mule deer?
Well, mule deer can migrate for dozens or hundreds of miles. There are a couple of great documentaries that I watched. I wish I could remember the names off the top of my head, but if people want to look up mule deer documentary, I think they'll find there's a couple of fairly recent films in which people track the mule deer migration, you know, on foot. They go and sort of follow the deer on foot. And they're doing that largely to point out the fact that these migration routes have been disrupted by things like fences and roads and natural gas infrastructure in the West and places like Wyoming. So that those, you know, very old migration routes are being disrupted, and it is having a measurable effect on those mule deer populations.
You actually describe a really heartbreaking scene in the book, and I'll warn those of our audience who are more tenderhearted. This is, it's tough to think about, but it's part of what you just described about the barriers that have come about and gotten in the way of natural deer movement. Talk about that young deer that you found after it had been caught in a fence.
Yeah, this was right down the road from my house. I live in rural Virginia on a, you know, sort of 1.5 lane road, and we often take walks up and down, and there's a little graveyard down the road, which we sometimes visit. And inside that, there was a fawn's body that we noticed that was kind of in an advanced state of decomposition, but it was caught by a hind foot in this wire fence that surrounds the graveyard. And, you know, fences are a frequent problem for deer. I don't know what happened in this case, but I'm guessing, you know, young deer are normally walking around just following their mothers through their home ranges, and it's probably easy for the grown adult to jump that fence, and the fawn just couldn't quite make it and somehow got a foot caught in this fence and could not escape. So you could sort of imagine this very sad scene there, and it just made me think a lot about the human impact on the landscape and how, you know, just the simplest things for a wild animal can be changed by the different ways that we claim space and change their habitat.
It brings to mind, too, when you were imagining how that scene came about, you visualized the mother trying to do something to save it, or, you know, at a wit's end because she couldn't do anything about it. And that brings us to the topic of anthropomorphizing deer versus really trying to understand how much they feel, whether they feel, how their minds work. What do we know about that? What do we know about anthropomorphizing the deer, and what do we know about how their minds really function in any given situation?
Yeah, this is a really interesting question because I think for a long time, certainly coming from the scientific world, there's been a sort of ban on anthropomorphizing animals. You know, it's thought that it would be wrong, it would be inaccurate to project human emotions onto animal experiences, and that that could lead you to incorrect conclusions about animal behavior and motivations. But I think that that's changing. And I believe, as a non-scientist, I believe that it should change. I mean, just at the top of the hour, before we got started with our conversation, there was a little item on the BBC News about orcas making tools out of kelp to scratch each other's backs.
Yes.
Just one more, you know, really fascinating piece of evidence in a number of these studies that have been showing that animals have their own form of language, their own form of culture. They have understanding of, in some cases, of the minds of other creatures. They have awareness of themselves. They have memories. They can make plans, you know. So I think that science is kind of coming around to what indigenous worldviews have held for a long time, which is animals are sentient fellow travelers on the earth, and they deserve to be respected as persons, not as human beings, but as having personhood. And that's kind of the, again, I'm not a scientist, but that's the, having contemplated deer now for several years, that's the attitude that I've come to share, that I just see them as worthy of our address. You know, they're not objects, they have agency.
I'm going to dive down a side street here and talk about the fact that you're a poet. And I think that came across a lot in the way you talked about how they existed and the art that they showed up in and how their minds might work. That your sense of poetry is obvious throughout. It doesn't get in the way of the science. It doesn't get in the way of the facts and the history. But I found it a great presence throughout. And I wonder what you think about deer as poetic subjects.
Yeah, well, thank you for your kind words. I'll take that all as a compliment. I think deer have been a favorite topic of poets for a long time, as they have been a favorite subject for visual art, for kind of obvious reasons. I mean, they're charismatic, they're iconic, they're extremely beautiful, they're fascinating, and they also, there's a resonance between deer and humans. And I think part of that, this sounds so simplistic to say, but part of it is because they are similar size to us. And so it's easy for us to identify with them, and there are certain things about them that remind us of ourselves. So there's been this kind of doppelganger or shapeshifter relationship that we've had with them in mythological terms for a long time, where there are many world myths and stories about deer and humans changing into each other or taking on each other's guise. And I think that in, you know, when I went looking for deer in contemporary poetry, I certainly found them as kind of icons of wilderness, or, you know, visitors who show up in the poet's yard and kind of snap the human out of whatever human concerns they had going on in their minds. And that's there for sure. But then there's other contemporary poets who tend to take deer as maybe a symbol of death, or a symbol of kind of human overreach, or you know, more kind of complex notions like that. And I just think that's something that's been true about deer for a long time, is that they can hold these different ideas. We can project many different things onto them, and they're sort of instant symbol. You know, you put a deer in a poem or a painting, and it means something. Maybe not always the same thing, but it's going to be meaningful.
Yeah. Let's tackle one of the conflicts about deer, and that is whether there are so many of them, as was once thought, you know, by white settlers here. There are so many of them, it's not like we can run through them all. They're going to be a constant source of deer. There will always be deer. There are people who think there are too many deer, and those are undoubtedly the people who get their gardens eaten every year. And we, you know, look at the point of view of the scientists to actually see that deer becoming extinct is not impossible. So what are we talking about in terms of the numbers of deer as opposed to how they're perceived by so many people?
Yeah, so this is both a topic for our moment, and it's a historical topic that goes back to the colonial part of American history, because as you mentioned, some of those early settlers from Europe really did believe that the deer were infinite. In fact, I think I quote in the book that Sir Francis Drake, when he landed in what we now call California and was describing the deer there, he used the word infinite, which is an interesting word to apply to an animal population that cannot possibly be infinite, but that's how he saw them. And there was this belief that, you know, compared with what people were used to in Europe, that this North American deer population was just so abundant and so available that it could never be exhausted. And they were wrong about that. They overhunted and they affected habitats to the point where the deer population hit a real low around the year 1900. There were actually entire states, a number of states, that were empty of deer, which is so hard for us to imagine now, but it did happen. And there was a concerted effort around that time by conservationists who were, interestingly, also hunters, concerted effort to bring back deer populations, rebuild them. They enacted legislation, they established refuges, they also restocked deer and moved them around from one place to another to reseed those populations. And as we said earlier, you know, the deer proved so adaptable and so able to live with this kind of rapidly expanding human population during the 20th century that by, you know, the time I was born in the 70s, people were starting to say, we might have too many, you know, we might have the opposite problem now than our grandparents had. And so where we are now is that they've declined a little bit from their peak population, which happened around the year 2000, but they are still very dense and very abundant in a lot of the places where people live, as we've been saying. So that does cause conflict. It causes annoyance. You mentioned gardens. That's a big source of friction between people and deer. And I'm a gardener too, so I understand that. You know, vehicle collisions are another reason. Tick-borne diseases are a third reason. And so there are many communities where people start to say, we need to do something about this. We have to manage the deer. And deer can also have an effect on their habitats, on native plants, and all the other animals that depend on those plants. So there are a lot of reasons that people start to feel like they need to manage deer, but it's always an emotional and controversial topic for any community.
All right, because even if you agree that they need to be managed, as soon as you get into the how, that's going to get awfully complex. And we're going to touch on that in the second half of our conversation. I'm Angie Cuero, sitting in for Rose Aguilar today. This is Your Call. Erica Hauser is with us. She is a poet, writer, journalist, and teacher, and the author of the book we're discussing, The Age of Deer, Trouble and Kinship with Our Wild Neighbors. You probably have thoughts about deer, and we'd like to include those in the rest of our conversation. So to give us your contribution, our phone lines are open, 866-798-TALK, 866-798-8255. Among the topics we'll be discussing is what Erica just brought up, the idea of hunters as conservationists, the danger of moving deer around, even if you're trying to do it for the benefit of the deer, and some of the modern challenges that deer face, including chronic wasting disease. That's all coming up, and we'd like your contribution to those topics, 866-798-TALK, 866-798-8255. If you prefer email, we're here for you as well. Write us at yourcall@kalw.org. We'll be right back here on Your Call. You're back listening to us on Your Call, and thank you for that. Our episodes are available on our podcast page. You'll find that at kalw.org/yourcall. You can sign up for our newsletter while you're there. If you have a show idea for us, the number to use is the same as the number for your calls during this hour, 866-798-TALK, 866-798-8255. And you can always drop us a line, yourcall@kalw.org. Erica Hauser is with us, and we're moving into the summit of the conversations about deer that we touched on briefly, including hunters as conservationists. And Erica, I know this is a topic of controversy for everything from ducks to deer to pretty much any kind of hunting and shooting in the wild. And I think people draw a very strong line between hunting for pleasure and hunting for food. How does that play out in deer hunting?
Well, you know, I think getting to know the hunting world a little bit in my research for this book was one of the most kind of eye-opening adventures I had in the process. I've never felt connected to deer hunting at all, never felt interested in it, although I did grow up with some hunters in my extended family, and, you know, there were some family friends who hunted. I grew up in Pennsylvania, outside of Pittsburgh. Deer hunting is a really big deal there. So kind of everybody knows somebody who hunts. So I was around it, but not part of it. And when I started writing the book, I knew I was going to have to go into that world and get a feel for how it works and who's hunting deer. Why are they hunting deer? What does it look like? And I was able to experience, you know, some of that. It's a big world. The hunting world has a lot of diversity and variation in it in certain ways. And so there's no way I could experience all of it. But what I learned, one of the things I learned was that it's not that easy, as non-hunters would often like to separate, you know, make a very clear separation between hunting for meat and hunting for pleasure. But once you're talking with hunters and watching people hunt, you realize that that separation is not very clear. It's very, I think, very, very rare for somebody to go out hunting for venison who doesn't have enjoyment or interest in that process. You know, it's a lot of work. So, you know, I think at this point in history, it's pretty rare to find somebody who's going to take that on only for their own survival. I don't think that's very common at all these days. And I think that hunters are people who are often very interested in wildlife. The process of hunting brings them into that interest and familiarity with wildlife that is really far greater than most of us non-hunters tend to have. Of course, there are exceptions to that, but you know, what it takes to be able to predict when a deer is going to show up where you would like to hunt, that's a lot of observation, a lot of knowledge, a lot of time spent, and a certain intimacy with the animals, their behavior, their life cycles, how they change their habits in different seasons. So hunters are also naturalists in a way. And so it starts to make more sense in light of all that when you consider that some of the most successful conservation efforts have been led by hunters who wanted to preserve their ability to hunt certain animals.
It reminds me of Ducks Unlimited, which you think was all about duck hunting, but they're also about conservation. They protect wetlands, they try to expand wetlands, they have voluntary conservation easements. Do you see parallels there as well?
Well, I think that it's a little, yes, there are parallels. It's a little bit different since I think, I don't know a lot about ducks, but I think they're a little bit more sensitive to habitat changes and disturbance than deer, since deer are so adaptable. But it's definitely a parallel in the sense that you can't conserve a species that you want to hunt if you don't think about, you know, somewhat think about the bigger picture of where those animals live and, you know, the various factors that might be impacting their ability to survive and reproduce.
Another thought that came to mind reading the book, although you didn't go into this in any depth, was the idea of who's out there hunting. I think that it's easy to imagine, like everything else today, it comes down to party lines. If you're out there and you're a conservative, you don't care about whether you're shooting deer. And if you're a liberal, you're a lefty, you're a soft heart, you'd never do such a thing. And in fact, there's a whole mix of people who are out there being hunters.
Yeah, absolutely. It's a much more varied set of people than you might think. You know, I interviewed several female hunters. Women are the fastest growing group of hunters currently, which is important because the overall number of hunters is declining. And, you know, if the goal is to manage deer populations, then you don't want your hunters to, you know, slowly disappear. So state wildlife agencies, which are in charge of regulating hunting, and they're trying to manage deer populations to certain levels, they're looking to women to kind of, you know, be the rising tide of people who hunt. There's also a kind of growing movement of hunters of color. And I think just in general, there's more diversity of viewpoints and styles of hunting and motivations for hunting than a lot of non-hunters probably assume.
You also talk to people about what becomes of the deer after the hunting. You watch someone stretch out a deer hide, and you talked about the history of Native Americans doing that. And you saw people who were dressing deer, and they were not just doing it for the meat. There are all kinds of things you do with the hide that you do with the internal organs of the deer. A deer can, at the risk of sounding callous, a deer body can be very useful, and there's something to be said about using everything about a deer.
Yeah, that was one of the most fascinating things for me was to, I talk about in the book, a list that I found of 101 uses for the body of a deer. And a few of those are food. You know, it lists a few different ways that you can prepare venison. But the majority of things on that list were not food. You know, there's a whole bunch of things you can do with a deer hide, first of all. The bones can make tools and other things, you know, think of hair ornaments or musical instruments. The organs, as you said, have various uses. One of my favorite examples was that the sac that surrounds the heart, the pericardium, which of course we also have, could be used to make a little purse or a bag. The hooves have uses. Even the scat and the urine have uses. Obviously, antlers have uses. So when I looked at this list and kind of contemplated it, I thought, you know, it's kind of a miracle that almost anything you can think of that humans in that kind of hunter-gatherer context might need, almost any need that they might have, could be met by this one animal. And that just really drove home to me their importance as providers of so much more than food. And of course, it's really rare these days for anybody to make such complete use of a deer that they've hunted. But there is a community of people who are interested in doing at least some of that. And I hung out with some of those people in the research process and wrote about that. And I just think it's a really, really interesting kind of, you know, small but fascinating corner of our culture today where people are trying to keep some of those skills alive. And they're pretty conscious of honoring the deer as one of their reasons for doing that.
In terms of honoring the deer, I want to put together two pieces of information in the book. First of all, you went hands-on in creating an awl out of two different bones, and you had to separate the bones and then sharpen the awl. And I put that together with the thought early in the book, you let us know that you've accidentally killed deer. And the first time, although the deer was still alive, you went on your way and obviously had really conflicting feelings about that. And I wonder about that contrast of feelings, what it was to be in a situation where you were responsible for the suffering and death of a deer, and the time when you held a part of a deer and turned it into a useful thing. Can you tell us about those feelings?
Yeah, it was pretty profound. I mean, like many people, I've had this experience more than once of driving and colliding with a deer, unfortunately, and not being able to make that right or help, just not having the skills to deal with that. And I think that's an experience that many of us have had, and it is a sorrowful thing. And so then years later, I'm sitting in this workshop at an earth skills gathering, and I'm holding the ulna and radius of a deer's foreleg, which again, we also have in our forearm, and working on separating them because one of the bones, and I can't remember which now, I think it was the ulna, we were going to make into an awl, like a tool to punch through leather, sharp tool. And it took a couple of hours to do this project. And as I'm working, I'm sitting with other people and we're talking and we're kind of talking about deer and about death and life. And it felt like a really sacred experience, actually. And it felt like an intimacy with this one particular deer, this individual animal who had lived. And I kind of wondered in the writing about this, is this some kind of atonement for not necessarily for the deer that I hit with my car? I don't think there's that direct a correspondence, but it just felt like a way to sit with, honor, and respect an animal that was so different than this experience we end up having when we're driving cars, these huge, heavy machines that can do so much damage.
That's a really beautiful passage in the book when you talk about a man who sat with a deer who was injured by a car and saw it into its demise, very lovingly held it while it died. Tell us a little bit about that person and his motivations in doing that.
Well, this is somebody I know locally who is the founder of an outdoor school for children and adults. It's called the Living Earth School. And actually, my children have been students there for years now. So full disclosure. But he is somebody who's really knowledgeable about the outdoors, broadly. And he does hunt deer as a matter of providing food for his family. And he had that same experience of colliding with a deer while driving. He pulled over. He could see that this deer wasn't going to survive. He got a knife out of his car and cut the animal's jugular vein to speed up the process of death. And then he did, sit, and he told me that he prayed over the deer and just offered his presence during that process of death. And then he brought the deer's body home, ate the meat, tanned the hide, and I don't know, but I can imagine he may have, done other projects with other parts, bones, and so forth, because he is knowledgeable about things like that. And I think that's such a profoundly different response than most of us are able to have. Just in the sense of responsibility, he had caused this death. It was accidental, but he was part of it, and so he decided to see it through.
Talking to Erica Hauser about her book, The Age of Deer, Trouble and Kinship with Our Wild Neighbors. As promised, we go to the phone, and in fact, we're going to Florida where we talk to Peter. Hi, Peter, you're on the air.
Hi. Yeah, I've got two experiences. One was that when I was a child, yes. I mean, I must have been about seven years old, because I remember being in a movie theater with my mother, and we were watching The Yearling. You know that story? It takes place, it's written by a woman. It takes place in Florida. I didn't know anything about Florida then. But at the end of the book, heads up here, they have to shoot this deer, this fawn, the yearling. And it's not done on camera, but you just hear this gunshot. And I got choked up. And I was at the age when I'm embarrassed, but my mother has seen me cry. It's the only time I've ever cried at a movie, to tell you the truth. It was just the sadness of that. And anyway, so there's that experience. But then In 1977, my family was at a vacation in California. Wawona Inn, you know the area?
Mm-hmm.
Do you know that area?
Roughly, yeah. You might tell our listeners where that is.
And near Yosemite. Mm-hmm. It's in the vicinity of Yosemite. And so we were there staying at Wawona Inn, and we staying in a cottage, and we saw a deer. We're like, oh, my God, look, a deer. And we were all hush, hush, hush. And it comes walking up to us. And next thing you know, we're like feeding it Cheerios out of our hand.
Mm.
You know, these animals were anything but afraid of people. I forgot what you called that, like inured. And they say, you know, don't feed the wild animals. These deer were like totally like, it was just an amazing, it was like a kind of wildlife interaction at the same time. They were like pets. We could reach out and pet them. These things that we were so like, oh my God, hush. What? Do you don't know that about that area? It's like amazing.
That is, Peter, I'm so glad you brought that up because that was something I was going to go into. Anyway, thank you for the call. And taking this over to Erica, there is that whole thing about whether you should feed deer. They are an animal of nature. You shouldn't be interfering. Or as we just heard from Peter, it can feel really good to do it. And some people, especially in terms of drought and ravaged areas, areas ravaged by climate change, it seems like the right thing to do to help feed a wild animal.
Yeah, it's one of many issues around deer that in my research process, what I kind of landed on was a pretty deep, I don't know. You know, I couldn't find a comfortable place to land on that issue as with so many others. It just seemed a little bit unresolvable to me. I mean, it's definitely true that, you know, wildlife biologists would tell you to not feed the deer. And there are some very good reasons not to do it, including the spread of disease, especially chronic wasting disease, which is a really big problem for deer these days and can be spread through deer, you know, sharing food that humans have provided.
Mm-hmm.
At the same time, there are these situations, and I was in one during my research in a place called Fripp Island, South Carolina, which is an island. It's a resort area, and it has a very, very dense population of deer that has become, like the caller said, inured to human presence and very, very comfortable with people. And in fact, the deer on Fripp Island expect to be fed by people because it's a common practice there, and they don't have a lot else to eat. So when I was there, because of the way they would come right up and clearly be asking for food and expecting it, I found that my own kind of, you know, ethical certainty about it's bad to feed deer really dissolved and left me, and I did feed them. And I just felt kind of disoriented by the whole experience, you know, in terms of the morals of it. And so, yeah, I think it can be a somewhat unresolved question whether or not to do that.
I do want to go into what you just mentioned, which is the chronic wasting disease. And like a lot of diseases that we see in nature, one of the big concerns is that it can cross over into humans. First of all, what is chronic wasting disease?
Well, it is a contagious disease that is caused not by a bacteria or a virus, but by something called a prion, which is it's described as a misfolded protein, but it can be passed from animal to animal, just like the more familiar types of pathogens that we know. It's very closely related to mad cow disease, and it's essentially the deer family equivalent of mad cow disease, and it has similar effects. It attacks the brain and the nervous system. So over, you know, when a deer is first infected, there are no symptoms for a while, but then more and more, you know, effects start to show up, and they become very thin, they start to act strangely, and it's invariably fatal. So the really bad thing about this is that a population of deer can be passing this disease amongst each other, and even if all those deer were to be removed from that landscape, they've still been shedding those prions into the environment, and the prions can stay in the soil and even be taken up by plants for years afterward, I think around 10 years. And if a deer then comes along who's uninfected into that environment and eats one of those plants, they can become infected. So it's a really scary thing. It is spreading steadily throughout the U.S. It was discovered in the late 60s in Colorado, and it's now in more than 30 states. And every year, there's another state or two that announces that they've discovered chronic wasting disease within their borders. So it's very concerning. It's really a big problem.
And cars are a problem. You note that over a million deer a year are killed by cars. Is there any way to tackle that, or is that just going to be a given? That's just part of the way we live.
Well, I write about one project in Charlottesville, Virginia, very close to where I live, where the possibility is being studied of essentially fencing off sections of highway where a lot of, so there's this problem has its own acronym, DVC, which is deer vehicle collision. So if you identify a stretch of highway where a lot of DVCs occur, you might be able to fence it off and essentially funnel the deer under the road through underpasses that already exist, like culverts or, you know, maybe where the highway crosses over a river and there's a bridge there, the deer can walk under the bridge, and other wildlife too. And so the Virginia DOT, where I live, has had some really good success with that idea outside of Charlottesville. And there are other, you know, localities where overpasses have been constructed. Those are expensive. And so if you're not doing that when a road is initially being built, it becomes very expensive to retrofit with that kind of overpass. So it's a problem that has some possible solutions, but it's hard to imagine that we're going to get those DBC numbers down to zero anytime soon.
One of the, I don't want to say it's a solution, obviously we're talking about deer who are already dead, but at least in terms of making something good out of this, an increasing number of states are allowing roadkill to be used as meat, and they'll donate it or they'll call someone who's interested in that and let them go get the deer instead. In the states that are resisting that, what's their rationale?
I would imagine it's a kind of taboo around health, and maybe there are some, I'm speculating here, but maybe there are some kind of class associations to that, that some folks would like to stay away from, you know, that this is something that we don't need to do. We're too civilized, we're too, you know, well off to have to eat our food from the side of the road. But it truly is a way to prevent waste, you know, if these animals are going to be dying anyway. I think it's really a shame for that animal's body not to be used. And again, it comes back to this idea of honoring, you know, honoring what they do have to provide, not in all cases. Sometimes, you know, the animal is just too damaged to use, but not always.
And I want to go to the topic, too, of climate change, of course. This is our One Planet series, and that comes up a lot, understandably. Absolutely intriguing sentence in your book. They may even be able to turn climate change to their advantage. That's not something you hear about too many animals. How do they take that as a good?
Well, what I understand is that in some places, because climate change is making, you know, spring come earlier, warm weather lasts longer, that the breeding season essentially can extend for deer. On the other hand, climate change is definitely causing problems for them as well. I think of the example of the Key deer, who live only in the Florida Keys. They're a pretty distinct subspecies of white-tailed deer. They're having big problems because of the fact that sea levels are rising, and that is encroaching on the areas where they traditionally have kind of stashed their babies. The way that deer take care of their newborn young is to basically find a place for them to hide and just leave them there throughout the day. And the mother will come and check on them now and then and nurse and so forth. But the babies basically hide and try not to be noticed by predators, and they're losing their spots where they've traditionally done that because they're becoming inundated with seawater. So, you know, climate change, I don't want to suggest that it's an unmitigated good for deer.
Yeah,
it
yeah, of not. Course. Mm-hmm. I want to finish on a lighter note because you did mention that you're a gardener, and I just want to talk a little bit about how you may have made your peace being a gardener and someone who appreciates deer.
Yeah, it's not been easy. I detail in the book a particularly frustrating season that we had when we had a lot of deer damage. We grow a lot of vegetables and also ornamentals. And it is, you know, it's kind of a constant back and forth. And just this year, we invested some time and money in a bigger and better fence to try to keep the deer out of the vegetables. So it's an ongoing, I'm about to say battle, but really what I want to suggest is that it helps to think of this as a game, not a war. game you don't always win, and that's okay. I just figure we're sharing the space, and, I can relate to being hungry and needing to eat, and that's what causes deer to eat our plants.
Erica Hauser, thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me. It was fun.
Erica Hauser's book is The Age of Deer, Trouble and Kinship with Our Wild Neighbors. If you want to look that up online, her name is spelled House Air, H-O-W-S. A-R-E. If you've missed any part of today's show or want to check out Your Call's previous shows, visit kalw.org/yourcall. Email us questions, comments, and show ideas, yourcall@kalw.org. Maliha Raz is on produced today's show. Kevin Vance is our studio engineer. In for Rose Aguilar, I'm Angie Cuero, and thank you for tuning in to Your Call.